Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. I'm your host, Cyrus Polizbon, and I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins, Anne Dudek, Nicolas Sarian, and Stuart Alsup III. Welcome, everybody. Today's quote is from Samuel Beckett, and it reads, "Confusion, too, is company, up to a point. Better hope deferred than none." Confusion is company. Better hope deferred than none. Zohar, could you start us off with your thoughts?
Confusion, too, is company, up to a point. And then it's not company anymore because it ghosts. It dumps you.
I'm so confused though.
It cheats on you with another lover. It says, nah, no. I think that's very interesting, right? There's a point at which confusion doesn't keep us company, but we don't know what that point is. But up until that point, it does. So that's the first point. It's not that confusion is in the abstract a companion. It's that confusion can keep us company, has the potential to keep us company. And if we accept that, then the question is, when is confusion good for us? When is confusion a kind of friend, a kind of mentor, a kind of lover, a kind of maybe an imaginary friend, like something that we could even talk to or cultivate a relationship with? And then better hope deferred than none. So again, does the first lead to the second? I don't know. Maybe it's a kind of confused statement, or maybe it's a parallel. We could think about how does the first point relate to the second, better hope deferred than none. But what they have in common is that you're turning something which is far away into something that's close. So what you want is understanding. It's far away, but instead of saying, oh, I simply lack understanding, you're turning that lack, that negative, a desire for understanding, into something positive. Ah, but confusion is here with me. Confusion will lead the way. It will point the way. It will help me get closer. And hope deferred is different than no hope. Again, what does hope deferred mean? That would love to explore with all of you. But perhaps hope deferred means that you don't have hope right now, but you hope that in the future you'll have hope. So a deferred payment is one that you can still put in your accounting, even if when you open up the bank account, you have nothing to show for it. But that's different than just a straight up zero. It's in financial terms, if you have a call option on something, it means you have the right to buy it. So perhaps hope deferred is like a call option on hope. Possible that you won't be able to buy the hope in the future because it will indeed be a hopeless reality and the hope will not be justified, but you can't know that your hope will be out of the money. There's a chance that it will be in the money. I wish Francis were here for this. And you can at least hope for the option to hope. Leave it at that for now.
Better compensation deferred than none. Hey, Nico?
There's always duplicity in everything that I put.
Zohar, what did you try to say this week?
It was like
confusion to his company. That's my justification for not communicating.
We can go back to the talks on masochism if we want.
Can we start Confusion LLC?
Confusion as a service.
Confusion Incorporated.
We're talking about Simone Weil a couple episodes ago, and Simone Weil was a religious thinker, but very idiosyncratic in her theology, very sort of modernist, existentialist, dark. And she imagines the relationship between God and humanity as that between two prisoners that are in separate cells that are scratching on the wall separating the two of them. And so they don't actually meet, but they are aware of one another's presence through these scratches. It's like pretty bleak, right? But it's still a form of connectivity. And Beckett is of the same 20th century milieu, having seen a lot of atrocity and a lot of despair. And the question is, so what do you do when you see the worst? How do you think about the meaning of life in the face of it? if you just affirm that everything is all good and rosy, you come off as tone deaf, as not in touch with evil. But at the same time, people do hope in these circumstances and they do find meaning in these circumstances. So how do you give words to that experience? And I think we've talked about this paradox as well in other podcasts where Derrida says, if the deed is not unforgivable, then there's no reason to forgive it. Like a person has to do the most unforgivable thing for your forgiveness to actually be forgiveness. Otherwise, it's just acceptance or something like this. And so similarly, if the situation isn't hopeless, then you can't hope. The act of hoping requires the situation to be hopeless for your hope to actually be a heroic posture. Otherwise, it's just, I don't know, to use a different word, maybe expecting or wishing or something like this.
What I would say in that case is that then maybe this is a cognitive jump, but God is only conceivable when there is, when we live in a godless era, as an idea or as however you want to conceive God, but or the search for deity. No,
you have that already in the book of Job, where that's the devil's argument to God, or Satan's argument to God is, like, it's easy for Job to be pious and faithful when he's got a good life. Take it all away from him and see if he's pious then. And so God's fine, I'll accept your bet, and does take away everything from Job. And then Job is pious, presumably, and is tested. And then God says to the devil at the end, and it's like, that was pretty cringe. Did you really have to take that? But does point to the point to this idea within a lot of religion of martyrdom and the fact that you only get to demonstrate faith when you're tested. Otherwise, your faith is conflated with a whole bunch of other things, and we can never know if it's actually pure.
We're gonna quote that cringe God, Satan.
Right. On that point. So it's like God wins the bet, formally speaking, because he proved Satan wrong. But then at what cost to his image, insofar as now we think of a God who would make a bet with the devil and in an effort to win that ego match is willing to put his devotee through the worst. It seems a bit cruel.
Yeah. Jealous God.
What I was going to say is, I don't know why, but after I read Coldness and Cruelty by Deleuze a few years ago, I tend to boil down everything to this discussion between sadism and masochism. I don't know. I have this, I'm just like talking to myself here a little bit, but the point of, let's say, my question to Job would be, what if there is no end to your suffering? No? Because when he's tested, no, he doesn't know he's being tested until God appears. So that's the trial of faith. But why do I bring the masochism thing is because that's not masochism. Because in masochism, you have a contract that says that you will follow all of these rules and you will reach a point where, you know, and you can always tap out. So
Job can tap out, actually, because his wife says to him, curse God and die, which is basically say you can tap out at any time. And he's, no, I'm going to be faithful regardless. Although it's also a question if he, what does faithful mean? Because he refuses to curse God, but he comes very close to cursing God, meaning he questions God, which the text presents as different than cursing God. Because with cursing, you have a certainty, whereas with questioning or criticizing, it's an open question. But Job says, how could you do this to me? And then God's response is itself a rhetorical question, where God doesn't say, I made a bet with the devil and I knew that you would come out proving me right. God says, where were you when I created the world? Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Like, where were you in the before times in our speak? Like, where were you during the Big Bang? You think you've got the universe figured out? You're nobody. Like, why are you even asking? Like, why are you wasting my time with those questions? Your mind is small. Which is true, I think, but also not the nicest thing to say to Job in that moment. But better that than what Job's friends say to him. His friends are like, you must have sinned. You must have done something wrong. God's ways are just, and ultimately you deserve it. Like, they're just, it's like the ultimate blame the victim. God doesn't blame the victim. He's just, it's beyond your pay grade. I'm sorry, but you don't have access. You don't have security clearance to get answers to those questions. But that's still better than getting an answer that's cruel, that's saying that you deserve it. So go, bringing it back to Beckett, confusion to his company. Job would prefer God saying, ultimately, I don't know why you're suffering. I can't tell you why, to the clarity that his friends, quote unquote, friends are bringing to him. But that's incorrect. And at the end of the book, God says, oh, Job's friends were wrong, and Job, you're right. And so it's not just that God gets to win the bet with the devil. Job also gets to win the bet with his friends, so to say. And say, I told you, his friends were just quoting scripture when they tell him all the stuff. So the book's super like deconstructive, because if you read the rest of the Bible, the friends are basically just saying what you would get from reading the rest of the Bible. And then God's, no, that part of the Bible is wrong. Job is right. So it's very unsettling, but confusion to his company up to a point.
It's fantastic.
The whole, the point also of the book of Job is that God is talking to Satan, no? Or to the devil. There's a machination between the devil and God.
Of course, I got to clarify that point, which is because we in modern times have a vivid imagination of what the devil is, thanks to medieval art and Christology. But in biblical and ancient context, the word for devil, from which we get Satan, is Satan. And Satan is actually, again, like Milton characterized him as a fallen angel. None of that actually exists in ancient times. Satan just literally means in Hebrew, the accuser. So you can think about Satan as a prosecutor and God ultimately as a defendant, or what do you call it? A public defender. Job is the defendant. And in a lot of ancient Hebrew stories, God is actually the prosecutor, and the prophet, such as an Abraham or a Moses, is appointed to be the defender of the people. So really the point is that there's nothing bad or evil about Satan here. Satan is just doing what he's paid to do, which is be an accuser. And interestingly enough, in other contexts, God is an accuser. And so you can't even point to that role of being an accuser and say that it is a satanic role, because in other contexts, it's a divine role. But what you can say, and I'll leave you with this point, which is courtesy of a scholar named Yohanan Mufs, is that whenever a human being plays the role of accuser, God gets upset with them and says, I didn't appoint you to be the accuser. I appointed you to be the defender. If you have to imagine a kind of court scene, and the point isn't which side is necessarily correct. The point is that you have a prescribed role to play in this courtroom drama, and you can't defect to the other side. The human role is to always typically be on the side of defending humanity. When we flip to the side of prosecuting humanity, we're playing God in some way, and that makes us makes us satanic.
That is awesome.
You're making me. I just read something recently. So I was reading this dialogue that happened around, I think, 40 years ago. It was between René Girard. Do you guys know who René Girard is, by the way? Yeah. And
no.
I'll do Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel. Yeah. So René Girard was this. Yeah. René Girard was this. Zohar, you want to do this?
Yeah. You can't explain Girard by Thiel, but this is the thing that at a meta level will make people interested in him who otherwise aren't interested in philosophy. One of his students at Stanford was Peter Thiel, who was an early investor in Facebook, as well as a board member in Facebook, who presumably bet on social media before it was proven out because of Girard's philosophy, which is that human beings are mimetic. So we desire what other people desire. And social media basically feeds this mimetic dimension of humanity. And so the total addressable market for mimetic desire is just like far more than we could possibly imagine. And now it's come to be an obvious point, as seen in the proliferation of Instagram and TikTok and whatever. But Girard was a 20th century literary theorist and theologian and philosopher who wrote a lot about envy and conflict in the Bible and conflict in Shakespeare. And his core thesis is that nobody desires anything for real reasons. They only desire it because other people desire it, and that the source of conflict is mimetic rivalry. And I can attest to this point because as a parent, kids in the playground, and they want the toy that the other kid has. But as soon as the other kid doesn't want the toy, they don't want the toy. So it's like we ascribe scarcity to things so that we can fight over it. And then the second point is that
dogs are like that too.
People don't conflict because they're different. They conflict because they're similar. And you might have heard the phrase, the narcissism of small differences, which is a kind of adjacent point. But Thiel, in organizing the org structure, I believe at PayPal, tried to apply this insight by making sure that people didn't work on the same things, because he found that organizational dysfunction was caused by people working on the same things and then having this mimetic rivalry.
He also said some really interesting stuff about scapegoating as well. Maybe we should go back to the point about what brought Girard into the conversation.
But. Yeah. So of course, yeah. So this, it's connected more to the scapegoating than the mimetic desire, because to put it shortly, like when everybody wants the same thing, that generates conflict and violence. And this violence is something that you'd have to, does not get resolved by itself, or let's say within the parties involved, but it gets resolved by a scapegoat, a bouc émissaire, like an innocent victim that has nothing to do in the conflict. So this goes back to the accuser versus the defender. That's why I thought about this. But the reason why I brought it up is because I'm reading this conversation between Girard, a guy called Walter Burkert, who is one of the most, if not the most important paleoanthropologist of the Greeks, the Greek religion in the 20th century. He's a Swiss.
Jakob Burkert?
No, Walter Burkert.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He has an amazing book called, which I love, it's called Homo Nekans, Man the Killer, which is about the urges of sacrifice in the hunt. It goes very well with Girard. And the third person is a guy called Jonathan Z. Smith. Zohar, are you familiar with him?
Wait, is that the French guy? He lives in France?
Jonathan Z. Smith was a disciple of Eliade. One of the big names that came out of the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. He's a very rationalist type of enlightened thinker. He has some very good papers. One of them, which I recommend, is called The Map is Not the Territory. He's all about taxonomies, methodologies. And what they had this discussion about 40 years ago about the origins of sacrifice. So you have Burkert and Girard on one side saying, no, like sacrifice, there is originary sacrifice. Like we can talk about sacrifice as an origin for things. And then you have J.T. Smith saying there is no such thing as sacrifice until we invent it as a proper enlightened rationalist thinking. We generate the categories and then we like set out to find them. It's not the other way around. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because there is a part in that discussion where Girard says that, how do I put this? That there is a specific biblical attitude to the world, which is that only comes from the Judeo-Christian tradition, that you cannot find it in any other tradition, I would say. And whether he's right or not or wrong, that's what he says. And the interesting thing is that he makes this clear distinction through Nietzsche, and saying that Nietzsche was the only one who realized this when he made a distinction between slave morality and master morality. And you find this in the genealogy of morals. Basically, to put it very shortly, master morality is someone who distinguishes between good and bad and says this is good and this is bad. Let's say it's the person who is, or the master who establishes the values. No? slave morality, which Nietzsche adjudicates the origin to the Semites, no? To whatever, however can we can use that term, the Semites, is not good and bad, but good and evil. Because the difference between bad and evil, and I get that, want to get your backlash on this, Zohar, please, is that evil is a category, was normally considered before Nietzsche as a theological concept, let's say a theological construct, like there is an origin of evil metaphysically or theologically. What Nietzsche says is that it's a product of moral psychology, to put it bluntly. Like, evil happens when someone cannot say that this is good and bad because they're in a position of, let's say, of weakness. So they have to, in a sense, do an inner working of psychology, what he calls a resentment or resentiment, like a pulsion that is geared towards establishing power is reverted onto itself. And instead of establishing or contesting the pulsion of power, the person says, I cannot do it because that person is above me or is evil. So it creates this. So what Girard says is that, that distinction, he sees it as two religions or two, let's say, traditions. Master morality is the one that does not have a problem with sacrifice and innocent victims. The biblical tradition, or what I said, the Semite tradition, to whatever extent you can call it the Semite religion, defends innocent victims. Is a defender of the innocent people or the other victim. It's an interesting parable, I think.
So, to say it very succinctly, most ancient myths tell the story from the perspective of the person in power. And the biblical tradition gives you a perspective from the powerless and thus the victim, if you want to map the sacrificial frame onto a lot of stories. There's the person who does the sacrifice and the person who is sacrificed. Mm-hmm. And so rather than accept that the sacrificed person deserves to be sacrificed, which is what you have in most traditions, the biblical one questions whether the sacrifice is a good sacrifice and suggests that maybe the one who sacrificed is innocent and doesn't deserve to be sacrificed. And in so doing, exposes the mechanism of sacrifice as one that we adhere to, even though we wouldn't otherwise even know that's what we're doing, for example. I agree with Nietzsche and I disagree with Nietzsche, because you wanted my pushback. So where I agree with Nietzsche is that the Greco-Roman tradition, especially the Homeric legacy that runs through it, which is basically the glorification of soldiers and warriors as the most noble thing that you can do. And while you certainly have kings in the Bible and warriors in the Bible who are glorious in battle, ultimately biblical tradition does move to like righteousness as the most glorious thing, which involves not necessarily conquest in battle, but some kind of like in conquest over your own animal nature to live a more virtuous life and a more controlled life. And so so he's critical of biblical morality because it's too effete and emasculates manly virtues. And we should go back to being like deadlifting gym rats that walk around with swagger. He said that because he was a weak dude with syphilis who didn't have the balls to ask anyone out. So he was the original incel. But where I disagree with Nietzsche is that it's not so binary. There's an option three. And option three is neither passivity nor activity, but some kind of harmony of the masculine or the feminine or the active and the passive. And he was anti-Semitic at Judaism in a very weird way, which is he hated Jewish religion for creating Christianity. So he was really anti-Christian.
Yeah, what was his beef with Christianity?
The problem with Christianity is that it's even more slave morality than Judaism. It's just that Judaism caused Christianity to exist.
Right.
Jesus, ultimate weak sauce. Because like turning the other cheek and allowing yourself to be sacrificed, that's dude.
Can we?
Man up.
Yeah. Can I interject something here? Because we can detail this as much as we want and we can, no? But another thing you could say about Nietzsche is that he was also anti post-classical Greece because he hated Socrates. So what the Greece he's thinking about is like the Greece of Heraclitus, no? Not the Greece of Plato.
Homeric.
You want to have two options.
Homeric.
Yeah. Like it's possible to lift and to be a soldier and also not to be a brute and celebrate brawn over brain. So I think the middle way is better.
Can we talk about Nietzsche and particularly because you could just give a very interesting insight and kind of overall picture of this guy as the original incel, a guy who sees this lack in himself and then projects this thing and creates this image of this beautiful master thing, but he doesn't have it himself. He seems like a very confused individual. And then the modern day also, I believe he was unknown during his lifetime, right? He wasn't really very popular.
Well, I wouldn't say that Nietzsche was, I don't know the exact age, but he reached a fairly successful position, academic position at a very early age within the German system. And he was well known within that system. Thing is, all of the work of Nietzsche, maybe with the exception of The Birth of Tragedy, is him writing in the wilds, to put it as a wanderer. The funny thing is that, of course, you can say that about Nietzsche, but then Nietzsche has been perhaps, you know, that, for instance, in the Second World War, you had the Nazis reading Das Spoke Zarathustra. I think it was carried by every soldier. But it was also one of the books that was, in a sense, within the military corpus of the Soviets, which was like, I think, Goethe, Nietzsche, and Marx, of course. It's very strange. I wouldn't call him this. Of course, he had a lot of problems, but I wouldn't call him someone who nobody knew when he was alive. He was in the margins, I would say.
He became a celebrity like pretty quickly after his death, though, and he died young of syphilis, as mentioned. He actually lost his mind.
There's a lot to. So there's two. I would say there's two incels if you want to think about it in that way, and it's like the when a philosopher talks about madness, he's thinking of two people, Nietzsche, and the one I like better for this sort of thing is Hölderlin.
Hölderlin?
Yeah. Friedrich. He's a poet. He was, he's Heidegger's favorite poet. Zohar could talk hours about this.
He was a romantic poet who was roommates in Jena with both Hegel and Novalis. So the three of them were hanging out.
Schelling.
Schelling?
Schelling,
and,
yeah.
And they were all trained in German philosophy, and then some maintained a relationship to it, and others said, philosophy is not the way. The way is poetry. And then so Hölderlin was like more in the poetry is the way rather than philosophy is the way. And these neo-pagans would write about the gods and try to create a sense of having a relationship with the ancient gods. But anyways, I feel like we're straying a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going down the rabbit hole here.
Stuart, what was your question?
Essentially, just he seemed like a very confused guy. And how did he came up with these interesting philosophies that have really changed modern history, both on the Soviets and the Nazis and everything like that. And so how did this kind of guy who saw this weakness and then projected strength actually then make such an impact?
So I have an answer. Let's add to his list of influences, though, also the American left in a huge way. So Nietzsche is a hardcore existentialist, and existentialism has an ambivalent or ambiguous legacy because there's one branch of existentialism that's libertarian, if you will, that's basically just, I'm going to do what I'm going to do and you love to see it, hate to see it, I don't care, crocodile tears, I'm just doing me and I can do it and that's it, might makes right, like Ayn Rand style. But then there's also this left-wing Nietzsche that feeds into like identitarianism, where it's my identity is important to me and I'm going to do it whether you like it or not. So as a critic of mainstream bourgeois morality, he feeds both the like libertarian and, if you will, like the identitarian left. And so in the 60s, you could obviously see that there's a left-wing Nietzsche that's, I'm not going to follow the script that society gives me. I'm going to do it my way. And Nietzsche was an academic, but he deviated from academia, as Nico was saying, and became more of like a social theorist. But his training was in philology. So he studied ancient languages and the origins of words, and then tried to create a whole worldview based upon looking at cultural evolution through these changes in words. And that's what Nico is pointing to with this very subtle slippage between the word bad and the word evil, which in a lot of languages are actually the same word. But then when you say that something's bad, what do you actually, do you mean that it's morally bad? Or do you just mean I don't like it, or it's painful, or right, or it's aesthetically ugly or something like this? So his claim is that bad originally was just, I don't like it. And then it became this whole moral category. Right. Thanks to the
it's
slate.
In German, because it's a distinction that is established in German, let's say beyond, before Nietzsche, which you have two words, Schlecht and Buße. Schlecht means basically, it means like disgusting. That's the bad. And then Buße is like morally bad or evil. In fact, you want to hear something interesting. Because to the extent that Nietzsche made this distinction, whether it's beyond Nietzsche, that's the real question, no? If we can establish a distinction between bad and evil beyond Nietzsche. And I, for instance, again, to bring Deleuze, no? Gilles Deleuze, French philosopher, he wrote a book. There was maybe, if you ask me, who has written the best books on Nietzsche? If you want to have some secondary literature on Nietzsche, there's three, and or we'll say four, but really three. Deleuze's book, which is called Nietzsche and Philosophy, Heidegger's book, and the third is by, it's actually someone who's still alive. Her name is Barbara Stiegler. She's Bernard Stiegler, who was someone who perhaps would be very interesting for us because he wrote a lot about technology, and unfortunately he killed himself like I think 2 years ago. In fact, a good friend of mine is his last doctoral supervisee in Paris. But his daughter, she wrote a very good book on Nietzsche called Nietzsche and the Flesh. Going back to what I was saying is that the first book that has been that Deleuze wrote is inspired by a previous book he wrote on Spinoza, where he establishes that the distinction that Nietzsche does between Schlecht and Buße, good, let's say bad and evil, is, you can find it in Spinoza already without a, let's say, language distinction, because I used to write in Latin, and in Latin there's only one word, which is malus, which is malo in Spanish, malus. No? So it's, how do we, to put it like in a, to bring it down, is the question is, how do we distinguish, let's say, our own insatisfaction or let's say the fact that something doesn't, we don't agree with somewhere, we don't like it, with the construction of, let's say, a negative morality, let's say, or let's say an idea of evil. And that's the question.
I have another thinker to contribute to the conversation, which is the medieval Jewish theologian Maimonides, who, so you all recall that Adam and Eve eat from the tree of knowledge of good and bad, or knowledge of good and evil. Again, in Hebrew, it's hadat tovara, good and bad. The word ra can translate as both bad or evil. What did they actually have knowledge of when they ate from that fruit? Did they have knowledge of the distinction between the morally good and the morally wrong? Or did they simply have knowledge of the pleasant and the unpleasant, to use this Nietzschean frame? And Maimonides says that pre-eating from the tree of knowledge, they had knowledge of true and false, but post-eating from the tree of knowledge, they had knowledge of good and evil. And that basically good and evil are value judgments, whereas true and false are fact judgments. And so the enlightened state, the paradisical state, is one where you just see things as they are without this attachment, which means the value attachment, which means the value attachment is a symptom of the fall. But here's where I think Maimonides disagrees with Nietzsche, which is that Nietzsche would say, and therefore we need to return to paradise. We need to get rid of these moral blinders because they're false, they're constructs, they're relics of some mistake. Whereas I think Maimonides and a Jewish frame would say, we live in the world as it is, and that world is a fallen world, and our job is to make that world better and to live within it, not to run back to paradise. And so we do live in the world of good and evil now. And so it's okay to have value judgments of good versus evil. And we can, at some abstract level, say that those are constructed or that those are somewhat illusory, but that doesn't mean we should actually live with moral relativism.
How does this relate?
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. How does this relate to being amoral and psychopathy and Machiavellianism and no good or evil? Maybe there is good or evil, but I just simply don't care. Like that type of thinking.
Like the book so Nietzsche talks about this in a book called The Genealogy of Morality. And what he said is that book is a specification, or it's a detailed, let's say, analysis on a previous book he wrote, which is called Beyond Good and Evil. And this is a real question, I think.
I have a thought on that, which is even the ancient Greeks, the Homeric soldiers, pursued glory and nobility. It's just that they derived those things from excellence in might as opposed to, let's say, excellence in, I don't know, how charitable you are, how compassionate you are. Like in Christianity, like the high status thing to do is go be a saint. And in Homeric culture, it's go be Ajax or Odysseus. So a psychopath who cares about glory would still be bound by some social contract. It's just a question of which social contract binds them. Is it like warrior culture? You could have a psychopath who seeks to be a saint, or a psychopath who seeks to be SBF. I can't claim to know his mind, but like for him, the most glorious thing was give billions of dollars away to effective altruist causes. Now, maybe that was purely a cover, but assuming that some of him believed it, we can see that it's like, and the Nietzschean would say, why is that egomaniac wanting to demonstrate his prowess in that way? It's because he lives in that culture as opposed to in the Homeric one where, that nerd wouldn't last a day.
FTX.
We're talking about FTX.
The video of him is the pure, like that video that went viral with the 1 minute Nas guy.
Yeah.
If you go back and look at it, it's just like a mimetic image after mimetic image of the effective altruist San Francisco type person. Just like he, it's just so crazy how, and the first time I saw that video, I was like, go with technology.
I don't think Nietzsche is recommending psychopathy. I think what he's saying is that there's a moral system, which is better than our current moral system. And our current moral system is highly moralistic and super judgy and filled with resentment and envy, where he was basically a critic of woke. So the more of an oppressed minority you are, like the more righteous you're presumed to be. And this is my critique of Nietzsche. So he flipped it in the exact opposite and was like, just revel in being strong and not giving, not giving a fig. And it's like, why can't you have some sane, moderate middle position where neither being powerful nor being powerless has anything to do with your goodness? And you're just like trying to live a good, balanced, decent life. It cares about your own flourishing, but also cares about other people's. But what I wanted to ask Anne, as a designer, thinking about good and bad versus good and evil, how you think about the intersection or not between the aesthetic and the moral, and what do you say to good people who produce bad art, and what do you say about bad people who produce great art, if that's possible in your conception?
Yeah, I think especially coming as an architect, like the idea of designing for public good, and public good is like very amorphous, because one example we talked about in school is there's a view of a pond. And it's good for me not to have a view obstructed by a railing. But for some other people, it's good to have a railing because they can't stand or they may fall in or something like that. So I think like there is no real resolution on what is good and what is good design, because it's constantly shifting based on like individual need and societal need. And then the question of like bad people that make great art, that's a lot of fucking people. Oh, sorry. It's just so many. Bruckner was a pedophile. Picasso was like a misogynist. There's just so many people that were terrible that made really nice art. And what? I don't know, maybe Nico can explain that a little bit more with his background in philosophy and art. But like there's a lot of people. And I think like before that wasn't really considered because the individual wasn't so considered in the creation of art. But now that we're very much turning a focus to the artists themselves, you've even seen pushback against the Picasso himself and Picasso's work, because as an individual, he wasn't an ideal citizen. So that's what I contribute. Maybe Nico can add some stuff there.
But do you think it's negatively correlated, like meaning or inversely correlated, that there's a higher chance that a bad person produces good art than a good person produces good art? Or if you take a comparable field, you're not going to find such a mismatch between the morality of the maker and then the excellence of the thing made. Like in let's say something like that's more purely functional, you're going to have a greater
performance as well.
Yeah. This is an idea I've formed in the last 45 minutes that we've been talking, and Nico's educated me on the difference between bad versus evil. So this is a working thesis here. So I think artists are generally outside society, right? There's like a difference in perception and reality that already exists for them in the way that like great art is made, because it is revolutionary and other. And so I think that there are some things, like bringing up Bruckner again, like that are objectively bad, evil potentially. But I don't know, it's hard to judge because I think I view artists as more other, that sometimes is viewed as bad, but is not. So I don't know, that's a new thought, and we can work through that in subsequent podcasts as we discuss bad and evil.
I don't know if this is helpful, but Hannah Arendt, in her book Men in Dark Times, which is her like eulogies for various great thinkers and artists that she perceived to be like a light in a time of darkness. And she wrote about Bertolt Brecht, the poet and playwright who was super communist. And at some point in his career, like where she claims he should have known better, remained a propagandist for Stalin. And she says in the moment where his art crossed into propaganda, he lost his art. And that there's a line. She agreed with your first point and then added something onto it. She basically said, artists do get moral leeway because they're artists, and we as a society do and should give them that moral leeway, but there's still a line. And we don't know where that line is in advance, but once they cross it, they don't just lose public's trust. Their art itself suffers. And she claims that his art got worse the moment that he crossed the line into propaganda. So that's interesting as well to think about, like, when does art become captured by evil versus it stands outside of it? And I think she would make the distinction between, this is going to sound bad, but a personal evil versus a political evil. So the Bruckner example, she might say his art isn't compromised because while his actions are wrong, they're not propagandist. But the moment that somebody engages in like partisanship, that's when the art suffers, because then the art serves that ideological function, stops being art for its own sake.
I want to do a pad. Sorry, you didn't say anything.
That's my role, is just to listen. One of the attitude and thoughts and points is, I in conservatory had a couple teachers who would say that it's don't apologize. They'd always say, stop apologizing. Stop being polite. Because so many people would come up, they'd do something and say, oh, sorry. They'd feel self-conscious or weird or whatever for whatever they put out there. And when you were talking about other being the other, artists being the other, I thought of that. Like when you lose, when you ignore politeness, it gives you license to go farther. And I think I'm just saying this because I'm trying to answer Zohar's question of, do you see more bad people producing great art than good people? I think it's maybe you perceive it as such because those people, more often bad people, quote unquote bad people, are going to care less about being polite than a good person is being unafraid to do something that's different because they simply don't care about the moral judgment applied to them.
But it's once you start disregarding the societal norms, which is arguably necessary to create great art, then that's like a slippery slope, right? When does that stop that you understand where the line is between what is a societal norm that's acceptable to dismiss versus what's not acceptable to dismiss? And so you can understand how people could start down a road and then just really lose sight of any chat.
Yeah. When does rudeness become like brutishness? Or
what do you guys think is worse, aggression or passive aggression? Because I think that might be another way.
Passive aggression every day. Like, it's the worst.
I think that's like
way worse.
I think that's like Nietzsche's critique. Yeah. Is that say what you want about those like warrior bros, at least they weren't passive aggressive. Like they said what they wanted and they acted on it. And all you quote unquote religious people are a bunch of hypocrites because you have the same psychological profile. You're just too cowardly to act on it. And so it's coming out in all these dysfunctional indirect ways, but it's still very much there. You're just now using morality as a kind of veneer for doing the same thing, which is this game of domination. It's just a game. And so
I have a question on that.
Yeah.
Because if we're talking, and I don't know a lot about Nietzsche's like history and like kind of his studying and connection to Greek society, but to me sometimes, and this may be a female perspective, but to me sometimes there seems to be this idealization of this, let's call it super bro past that existed in Greek and Roman times, where like they were not ideal societies. It's like looking back at a bad relationship and like pulling out all the parts that you thought were awesome and saying, this is how we should be. And yeah. So I think like for me, like what point does that play in like this discussion where we're looking back and you're thinking of a sculpture that was made in the Renaissance about a person who lived in these ancient times and subscribing this idealization of masculinity or whatever to it versus the reality of the civilization.
Yeah, I think that's a legit critique, but if I'll put on my Nietzsche hat and try to answer as best as I can. So the first point is you're correct. I am saying that things have gotten worse and that it would be better to live in that society than in this one. If you disagree with it, that's probably because you got the woke mind virus, but here, take my red pill. I'll show you why it was. and the second point is nobody's saying that the criterion for judging this society is whether people as a whole were happy. Happiness is overrated. What matters is actually the excellence that the society produces. And if it could produce a Homer, if it could produce an Odysseus, then we should judge it by its cultural achievements, not by the median voter's being. Yeah, maybe 99% of society was miserable, but it was worth it.
But they had the aqueduct.
Well, so, but the like... point is that society, but so, the whole point is that society was a much more, what we call society in ancient Greece is not what we mean by society today. That's like women were not part of the polis. Like anybody who was not part of your own polis, you were allowed to kill them. If you were a barbarian, like that means you're not from my, you can go and kill that person and that's totally fine. There is no, so it's just, we entertain the thought, but in fact, like Yeah. It's impossible to conceive that, no?
I gave you like the reactionary Nietzsche answer, which is like kind of fascist. But you could give a more moderate, version, which is, I'm not saying that we want to go back to the past and relive it like as a whole, but there's this current kernel of truth that we've repressed and shut down. And we need to find a way to integrate that into our modern life. So like we become too hypocritical as a society in thinking that we've sufficiently advanced from our ancient forebears. And we need to be honest about the fact that we're still subject to the same psychology and anthropology, but right. We're just less transparent to ourselves. And that's a bad thing. And by the way, that's Freud's point as well.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So what you get with this reading of saying, let's say, okay, people talk about theology, but really what they're talking about is morality, because you project these things, no? What you get out of that is Freud. And this is no surprise. Like everybody is documented. When Nietzsche wept, good movie. I just wanted to answer one thing that Stuart asked earlier, like 10 minutes ago, which is if the FX guy is a psychopath, no?
FTX. Yeah.
FTX, sorry. And if from a more clinical, a psychoanalytic clinical...
I think he's an artist, by the way.
No.
he's a quant artist.
I'm not sure, but I think I'm insulted.
I don't know. There's a Michael Lewis book that came out on him, but then people are saying that Michael Lewis was taken in by the dupe and that book is too partial to Sam Bankman-Fried and that he got played because of his own priors where he wanted to particularly portray SBF as a hero. And so I've seen people are like, Michael Lewis should have written the book, but written it as a fiction because then he could have done the happy ending, but instead he wrote the happy ending and then SBF is in jail. So this is like a mismatch between his view of SBF and like the courtroom's view of SBF. I have many thoughts on it, but obviously we can't look into his mind and know what's in there if indeed it's clear. But we can know that my mental model is that he loved betting and all, in my view, had almost an addictive relationship to taking bets that from a common sense point of view would be considered aggressive and risky, but that from some mathematical perspective might be okay. And maybe they're not, maybe from a mathematical perspective, we're also not okay, who knows? But that essentially like he wasn't in it for the money. He was in it for the joy that he took in making these bets that alienated other people, but that he got to feel were correct bets at some in his mathematical universe. Possible that he also just got lazy and was disorganized and did some fraud. But one way to think about the counterfactual is if the price of Bitcoin didn't go down and there wasn't a crypto winter, like he had a not insignificant chance of becoming a trillionaire. And in that quite possible world, let's call it a world of 50-50 world, he wouldn't be in jail. Nobody would be trashing him. He'd be like the biggest philanthropist who ever lived and the biggest donor to every single Democratic candidate. And he'd still be getting glorified like profiles in the cover of Time and the New Yorker, and people would be talking to him like he's super wise. So what do we make of that? That like he was correct because it was a coin flip and he almost got there? Like he might say yes. Or should we be horrified by the fact that what other people right now are getting the magic treatment? And we're just suckers for fame and mimesis. And there's probably a lot of other frauds out there, but because they haven't been exposed and won't be exposed, we just go along with it. And, oh, yes, tell me more. That's so awesome.
What I get from that is I'm going to look for a cave where I can retreat from society from, basically.
But you can get it gets very dangerous when you start thinking like this, because to what extent, if everything is mimesis at the end of the day, to what extent can you establish, let's say, this is good mimesis and this is bad mimesis? No?
It's all the medic contagion.
It's no, all just, because, sounds I mean, like a lot of confusion.
I can tell you what good mimesis is.
Because it means, because Giordano talks in these terms also. He says,
give me a possession, I will tell you what good mimesis is.
Yeah. What's your hurdle rate? What's your hurdle rate?
You know,
Good Mimesis is bringing in 10 more active engaged users. I have to bring in 10 more active engaged users. That's what Good Mimesis is.
I hear that in my sleep.
Some lightning merch. It's coming.
The master.
Merchandise deferred.
I have more and more thoughts, but we can pick it up the next.
I feel like I want to get final words from everyone on the actual quote.
On the original
to his
quote.
Company up to a point.
Nine stars.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I spend about 80% of this episode confused. It was a great companion through this journey and provided hope that maybe one day I will know as much as Zohar and Nico. If I keep listening to the Lightning Podcast.
What I want to say is that the more confusing everything gets, so beware.
The more you defer hope, the more hope you can have that it will be deferred so that you can get more of it.
I'm in a similar boat to Anne. I've been this whole week has been a very confusing and brain foggy week, and today this morning was very brain fogged. And so
you're in Buenos Aires right now, like Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Getting ready for what's coming
there's an election. You're talking about there's an election. Could be very crazy results. So that could just be me feeling everybody else's confusion. Yeah, it's all crazy.
Well, and then the reincarnated dog that's in the cabinet.
Yes. We could do an episode on all of this.
Yep. Better discussion deferred than none. Sounds good, guys.
I will leave with a question, which is whether hope needs to be justified or whether hope creates the justification. And so I think a lot of people have the default of, if the hope is justified, then I'll hope, because I don't want to look like a fool who's hoping for something that ain't going to happen. But I think what's really cool and heroic is hoping, and thus, by virtue of hoping, actually creating the conditions for that hope to be fulfilled because you were willing to put yourself out there. Maybe I just have a hope bias, but I would definitely defer the hope rather than not have any.
To quote from Santa Claus, the movie, seeing isn't believing, Dad. Believing is seeing. Thank you, everybody. Have a good weekend.